Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Other People's Wars, The U.S. Military and the Challenge of Learning from Foreign Conflicts, by Brent L. Sterling. Narrated by Sean Renette. Introduction. Happily, we may profit by the experience of others without suffering the evils that attend the practical solution of such problems. Secretary of War Jefferson Davis. On Thursday, April 5th, 1855, three highly regarded soldiers, Major Richard Delafield, Major Alfred Mordecai, and Captain George McClellan, entered the War Department building, located just northwest of the White House, to be briefed on their unprecedented mission. Awaiting them was Jefferson Davis, whose heroic exploits as commander of the 1st Mississippi Rifles in the Mexican-American War had propelled him to prominence and his current office. Victory in that conflict, less than 10 years earlier, instilled a healthy confidence in the U.S. officer corps about its ability to meet defense challenges. Davis, not wanting the Army to rest on its laurels, dispatched this trio, subsequently known as the Delafield Commission, to observe the ongoing combat between three of Europe's leading military powers. Physical distance, combined with diplomatic obstacles, meant they disappointingly did not reach the Crimean Peninsula until just after the British and French captured Sebastopol. Still, when the weary soldiers sat down again with the secretary 13 months after that initial meeting, the commissioners possessed a wealth of information. For example, the group documented the outstanding performance of the new French 12-pound field artillery piece, the failure of the much-touted British Lancaster 68-pound rifled artillery gun, and the increased power projection capabilities of modern militaries. Davis and other American decision-makers had to assess whether these findings were accurate lessons about contemporary war, and whether they should be applied by the U.S. Army. The answers were mixed. The service eagerly embraced the French 12-pounder, which provided excellent support as the primary field gun for both the U.S. Army and Confederate Army in the Civil War. Information on the Lancaster gun's failing imbued War Department leaders with confidence in the continuing viability of masonry fortifications. But such works proved highly vulnerable from April 1862 with the introduction of effective rifled artillery. The U.S. government largely ignored as irrelevant the overarching lessons about the expanded scale of war and power projection potential, contributing to the chaotic scramble at the outset of the internecine American fight and potential danger if the British and French allied with the Confederacy. Although widespread belief exists in the military ranks that victory smiles upon those who anticipate the changes in the character of war, not upon those who wait to adapt themselves after the changes occur, soldiers, sailors, marines, and aviators struggle with foreseeing shifts in combat dynamics and fear errant choices. Based on their experience, imagination, and study of highly regarded foreign armed services, officers devise or copy new weapons, alternative organizational structures, modified training regimes, and innovative tactical and operational concepts. Before introducing such reforms, the services attempt to validate their merit through experiments, field trials, and war games. Truthful evaluations require realism and rigor. But satisfying those conditions is difficult for cultural, informational, fiscal, and safety reasons. Even when evidence supports proposed measures, reluctance often exists to initiate major adjustments. As Stephen Rosen opines, military organizations are large bureaucracies, and almost everything we know in theory about large bureaucracies suggests not only that they are hard to change, but they are designed not to change. As a result, battle-tested practices usually act as a cognitive anchor long after the war in which they occurred. Unsurprisingly, militaries tend to struggle at the outset of conflicts. Given the difficulty in pre-war preparation, some military historians stress the importance of adaptability after fighting commences. To enable such interwar changes, The U.S. and other militaries have developed robust programs to learn from their combat experiences. Yet proficiency at adaptability does not eliminate the significance of pre-war preparation. Even historians stressing such learning acknowledge that taking advantage of new data is heavily dependent on the soundness of the service's pre-war foundation. Moreover, at times the gap between opposing forces is so great that the opening campaign proves determinative, rendering adaptability irrelevant. Plus, a credible standing military capability has critical importance for states' abilities to deter aggression and thus avoid war. The very term war game, Kriegsspiel, reflects the desire to discern deficiencies without actual combat. Unfortunately, informational benefits of such simulations do not match the data provided by actual combat. Officials have even suggested manufacturing modest military action purely for knowledge acquisition. For example, Assistant Secretary of the Navy Theodore Roosevelt advocated in late 1897 for a Cuban landing, if only for the sake of learning from our own blunders. Such provocative behavior, however, rarely if ever occurs in modern times. The best potential source of battlefield knowledge outside of one's own combat is other people's wars, but learning from such events is challenging. For an army that had been at peace for many years, German military theorist Karl von Clausewitz recommended that some officers should be sent to observe operations and learn what war is like. Whether or not armed forces have recent fighting experience, as William McBride notes, other people's wars have been touchstones for modern military professionals. Even conflicts between smaller, less powerful nations have potential for revealing the effects of new technology, tactics, or systems. Andrew Krepinevich characterizes such battles as precursor wars, the neglect of which imperils major powers existing in an unstable security environment. Nevertheless, the extent to which attempts at learning from these events has led to better preparedness is an open question. The idiosyncratic nature and investigatory difficulty of foreign wars complicates accurately capturing what happened. Historian Robert Cetino pessimistically writes that external conflict examination since its 19th century origin has proven a highly problematic venture, one that resists any kind of scientific or objective standards. Even with accurate data, doubt exists to its relevancy. President Theodore Roosevelt cautioned the U.S. Army Chief of Staff after the Russo-Japanese War against following in servile fashion the victorious Japanese, because not all of the things they have done have been wise, and some of the wise things they have done are not wise for us. Sound advice, but such guidance is prone to abuse if findings suggest the need for bureaucratically or culturally unappealing changes. We need to better understand the dynamics of learning from foreign wars to avoid recurring pitfalls and maximize their utility. This subject has been neglected, in contrast to an extensive literature examining learning from one's own experiences. Previous works have consisted of either single-case victories, for example Greenwood, Huntanen, Moten, or investigation of multiple experiences from a single war or era, for example Luvas, O'Connor, Vaca. These studies yield insights about the practical challenges involved in such efforts and some ability to consider the relative merit of contrasting approaches. They, however, preclude discovery of recurring obstacles and enablers of success across different periods and contexts. The potential to obtain such understanding exists from an exploration of multiple attempts by a single military over an extended period as it developed institutionally and as the nature of war evolved. Completing such an investigation involves answering a series of distinct but related questions. How did the service attempt to discover what happened? What types of lessons were identified and what were missed? When, why, and how did the service apply its findings? What accounts for the resistance to using such information, and was such pushback appropriate? Why did implementation at times provide effectiveness, but in other cases prove counterproductive in preparing for future war? How do the dynamics of such learning efforts differ from attempts to benefit from one's own experiences? To answer these questions, I conduct an inductive investigation through a series of in-depth case studies. The work, however, has been informed by three interrelated literatures that address aspects of learning and military change. The first and most developed area attempts to understand why militaries innovate, why they initiate significant reforms that produce improved battlefield performance. One school of thought stresses the role of external, civilian pressure, often in cooperation with maverick officers, in overcoming an institutional reluctance to adjust. Yet the frequent failure of even highly motivated civilians to achieve their desired objective has led others to place the primary onus for innovation within militaries. A range of distinct explanations exist for such internally directed change, including the armed forces' position in the governing process, inter-service competition for scarce reasons, and inter-service dynamics. For intra-service dynamics, improvement results when proponents of a new theory of victory, especially senior officers, successfully combine collected evidence with internal politics to prevail over status quo preferring forces. Scholars have increasingly stressed the role of organizational culture as a factor in promoting or frustrating change, given its effects on the collection, evaluation, communication, and embrace of new knowledge. No theoretical reason exists to dismiss or give an a priori preference to any of these explanations when considering the influence of combat lessons from a foreign war. Given the relatively limited and hard-to-acquire data compared to that available from one's own experiences, one might expect the increased need for external pressure to learn from a foreign war. Yet findings from such conflicts, especially those of modest political significance, are likely to be of much greater interest to military audiences, fueling inter- and intra-services battles over how best to react. For insights into the process by which militaries assess the desirability and practicality of responding to external cues, the literature on the diffusion of military power is instructive. This subfield focuses not on the initial innovation, but on the transfer of that knowledge throughout the international system. Whereas neorealists expect competition between states to precipitate uniform diffusion, these scholars stress that it varies with the social, cultural, organizational, and political context. Researchers have identified a number of reasons why nations embrace or reject major military innovations, including cost requirements, degree of organizational decentralization, veto points, ability to experiment, breadth of organizational focus, mission, and compatibility, perceived fit of innovation with organizational culture, values, and needs. This literature also makes clear that rather than a binary adopt-not-adopt decision, militaries pursue a range of responses. Copy, selectively emulate, modify for different circumstances, counter, neglect due to low priority, or reject. Despite the relevance of the diffusion research, some notable differences exist. First, their unit of investigation is a development. For example, a major military innovation, compared to an event, for example, a foreign war, with potentially many meaningful lessons, big and small, on a wide range of topics. Second, diffusion scholars' interest begins only when the international community has sufficient data, a demonstration point, about an innovation's effectiveness, unlike foreign war investigators. The literature on organizational learning and knowledge management provides insights about the collection of information as well as the understanding of what militaries do with that data. Scholars in this field point out that lesson drawing begins with individuals either through experience, hands-on, or reflection, reading, listening, thinking. For these discoveries to be beneficial, the organization must have structures and processes to transition such findings into institutional learning via knowledge acquisition, analysis, dissemination, and absorption stages. Achievement of this goal requires satisfying three conditions, as Janine Davidson explains. There must be clarity and consensus regarding the events that occurred, what happened or what is happening, what those events mean, why this matters to our organization, and what the proper course of action should be, what should be done about it. Research has shown that certain factors enhance military learning, such as information flow, horizontal as well as vertical, commitment to rigorous experimentation, openness to disruptive data, and a collective problem-solving mentality. Moreover, leadership plays a significant role in strongly hierarchical organizations, such as the uniformed services, either facilitating or impeding knowledge growth. Finally, lesson drawing needs to be prospective, considering whether what is successfully done today will improve conditions in the future. This task is particularly difficult, but essential for militaries who are engaged in dynamic and obscure competition with adversaries simultaneously adjusting. The U.S. military has attempted to apply these insights in developing an increasingly sophisticated program to learn from its own experiences. Such learning largely occurs from the bottom up, as frontline units discover deficiencies with the status quo from combat and even exercises. Case studies documenting this process have prompted criticism of the aforementioned innovation theories for disproportionately weighing top-down change mechanics. While scholars have explored more integrative models, militaries have attempted to improve the collection and use of bottom-up inputs. Struggles in Afghanistan and Iraq reinforced for the U.S. services the benefit of becoming more effective learning organizations. For one's own experiences, soldiers, sailors, aviators, and Marines are present at the information source. But effective collection of information on a foreign conflict requires a dedicated effort initiated by the leadership. Thus, learning from other people's wars is largely a top-down process. Moreover, the assessment and reaction to findings occurs in distinct decision contexts. During war, a necessary delegation of authority to the tactical level abets rapidly translating battlefield discoveries of best practices and issues needing resolution into improved performance. In peacetime, when considering lessons from foreign wars, military organizations revert to their strongly hierarchical nature and display reluctance to accept findings that diverge from the sentiment of the service's leadership and organizational culture. While these contextual differences will likely lead to distinct approaches for maximum learning, shared core elements of the tasks allow taking advantage of the well-established definitions used by the U.S. military for its own experiential learning when characterizing key terminology for the investigation of foreign wars. Beginning in the late 1980s, after a long failure to delineate terms, especially lessons learned, the Army issued formal definitions as a part of the effort to standardize and enhance learning from its own experiences. The U.S. military has refined this terminology through several generations of guidance over the last 30 years. As a result, the current versions clearly and accurately depict the basic process elements, so I use them in this study. Of course, participants in the pre-1980s cases did not possess such clarification, and at times used words, especially learning, in different ways. Such a tendency does not present a difficulty as long as I maintain consistency in what is actually occurring. The process begins at the information gathering stage with the collection of observations, insights, and lessons. The most recent Army Lessons Learned program guidance defines an observation as a statement of the conditions experienced or observed with recommended changes to improve performance, and a lesson as a potential solution to a problem experienced as a result of an observation. Importantly, this document conveys the value of both positive, evidence-supporting sustainment, as well as negative, evidence of need for improvement or change, data. Most critically, what is a lesson learned? Scholars and practitioners appropriately differentiate between drawing a lesson and learning a lesson. The latter requires application of the former. What is meant by application, however, is a source of disagreement. Some commentators limit learning to organizational action. Typifying many commentators, Robert Foley, Stuart Griffin, and Helen McCartney contend that only when positive change has been made can a lesson really be said to have been learned. Similarly, the most recent Joint Chiefs of Staff Joint Lessons Learned Program, JLLP, guidance characterizes a lesson learned as an operationalized, resolved issue or best practice that resulted in behavioral change and improved operations or activities. Beneficial impacts can occur across the full spectrum of doctrine, organization, training, materiel, leadership, personnel, facilities, and policy, DOTMLPFP. But decision-makers attach particular attention to the first four subjects. Yet the requirement of adjustment for learning to take place omits two valuable uses of collected information. First, consideration of other people's mistakes can prevent adoption of harmful changes previously under consideration by revealing what not to do. Second, findings may indicate the continuing viability of existing DOTMLPFP. As the 2005 version of the JLLP guidance states, a lesson learned also results from evaluation or observation of a positive finding that did not necessarily require corrective action other than sustainment. Such effects should not be dismissed as of trivial importance, given doubt about status quo methods and techniques the more time passes from a prior war and the emergence of alternative approaches and new technology. As I noted, consideration of a single military's efforts to learn lessons from foreign wars offers an unexplored way to identify recurring challenges and issues, as well as potentially ameliorating measures in this nuanced, multi-stage process. Although a half-dozen militaries qualify as potential candidates, I selected the U.S. Armed Forces, given the varied environments in which it has conducted such investigations and the relative availability of information. My initial thought was to examine a combination of conventional wars and counterinsurgencies, but I decided to concentrate on the former because extended U.S. operations in Afghanistan and Iraq over the last 20 years have prompted numerous studies of prior counterinsurgency efforts, for example, the British in Malaya, the French in Algeria, and their impact on the U.S. Army. Rather than rehash this terrain, I consider learning from four conventional wars between the 1850s and 1970s. During this span, the active army transitioned from a small, decentralized, 15,000-man force with minimal investigative capability to a large, complex, nearly 800,000-man institution with expansive analytical and educational components. Given that most research on this subject has focused on ground forces, I also consider how either the U.S. Navy or U.S. Army Air Corps Air Force responded to each conflict. The study begins with the Crimean War. The Army's Delafield Commission marked the first major American attempt to observe a foreign war, occurring only a half decade before the U.S. Civil War. The Navy conducted no formal fact-finding assessment, but key U.S. sailors sought insights at a time of rapidly evolving technology. The Russo-Japanese War offers a case of strong interest for the Army and Navy, both undergoing substantial institutional development and facing notable technological changes. 30 years later, after significant post-World War I improvements to the tank and aircraft, the Army leadership appreciated the potential of the Spanish Civil War to yield valuable information about the evolution of modern war. This case technically involves only the Army, but the Army Air Corps operated with considerable autonomy and possessed a sharply divergent perspective on the Iberian struggle. Finally, the Yom Kippur War warrants inclusion as the most extensive, by far, American foreign war investigation. As the Army and Air Force transitioned from a focus on the Vietnam War to the Soviet threat in Central Europe, U.S. officers regarded the intense, lethal Arab-Israeli fighting as almost a proxy for combat with the Russians. Each case study starts by considering the way in which the services collected data. Then I identify what information each institution obtained and what it missed and why. Subsequently, I explore efforts to apply findings, especially to doctrine, organization, training, and materiel. Some applications involve maintaining the status quo, but most are adjustments, either innovations, transformative changes, or adaptations, incremental changes. Whereas military change scholars have long focused on innovation, they have increasingly appreciated that adaptation is not less significant in facilitating preparedness. Although apportioning responsibility for multi-causal actions is an admittedly hard task, understanding organizational learning is not possible without careful assessment of how a service used the data. The skewed emphasis on the discovery phase in previous studies of foreign war investigations has, I believe, accounted for an excessive dismissiveness of findings' impact, as commentators look for the rare instances in which a lesson provides the sole impetus for change. Such a perspective neglects the often meaningful contribution of insights in shifting the balance of argument in ongoing debates. This impact reflects what scholars describe as a key for organizational learning: how to integrate acquired knowledge into existing knowledge to facilitate superior understanding and improved practices. The subsequent case studies revealed that applied findings from foreign wars benefited the U.S. services in three basic ways: instrumentally, instructionally, and inspirationally. That is, the combat, one, generated compelling evidence used to overcome resistance from military and/or civilian officials to doing what had already been recognized as necessary by a group of officers, a force subcomponent, or even the entire service. Two, provided insights on how to better prepare for and conduct martial affairs, and three, sparked recognition or increased appreciation of battlefield challenges requiring resolution, and even at times fueled imaginative responses. Although the U.S. military's learning capacity and performance generally improved, except for the Spanish Civil War case, recurring pitfalls in both the discovery, for example, allowing pre-existing preferences to corrupt interpretations of what happened, and application, for example, embracing cues that rapidly became obsolete, stages impeded performance. The book's conclusion lays out the most problematic hazards for learning lessons and considers how best to overcome or minimize their impact. Looking for practical benefits from investigations of other people's wars, the U.S. military, especially the Army, has tended toward rapidly drawing preliminary findings and seeking hard, quantitative data to support such insights. While producing some notable benefits, this orientation problematically discourages attention to operational and strategic elements and dangerously promotes static, not dynamic, learning. A more effective approach requires broadening both the investigative scope and perceived applicability of findings. That is, rather than a tasking-driven exploration of subjects deemed highly relevant to the service mission, the endeavor needs to encompass as full a history as possible and respond to cues in areas of potential, not just current, relevance. Such a perspective protects against mistaken assumptions about what will be germane, especially once salient areas of warfare not regarded as relevant today are almost always less well understood, and thus where the institution would gain the most from applying foreign war information. To best contribute to military preparedness, lessons learned should not only strengthen core competencies, but also enhance adaptability, given the likelihood of the next war occurring in an unanticipated manner. As part of this effort, the armed forces must consider not only a foreign war's combat, but also what other militaries identified as lessons from the conflict and their application of that information. How I arrive at this somewhat contrarian perspective in favor of a broadened effort requires returning to 1855. and considering that and subsequent American experiences. Chapter 1. The Crimean War. Partial but precedent-setting probe. The contest that commenced in 1854 between the principled military and naval powers of Europe gave rise, during its progress, to the belief that the art of
Sample complete. Ready to continue?